Okay, so let us continue. So now, happens to be, let's just recontextualize ourselves. A week ago, what we did is we started going through Perek Ches in Sefer Shmuel Aleph. So we went through the text that's more or less familiar to us, which means now is the jumping off point. So from now onwards, we can consider the ideas a little more, and then we'll head back to the text when it actually happens. So here's the deal. This is, before we even get into trying to understand what's going on in Sefer Shmuel, we need to understand what's going on in Judaism. So what do I mean by that? I remember when I was in Yeshiva a long while back, there was a fellow who came to me and said, we were chatting on Friday night, and he said, you know, that when Mashiach comes, it's going to be a democracy. Meaning, in the new Israel, it's going to be a democracy, is going to be the political structure of the day. And I was a little taken aback, because, you know, we're so used to thinking about kings and monarchies as being part of Judaism. And you read Tanakh, and it's full of kings and monarchies for most of our Jewish history, at least in Israel onwards. And you think to yourself, well, how could it be anything else? And we have to ask ourselves exactly that question. Does the Torah prescribe a particular political system or not? That's before we even get to what happened in Sefer Shmuel, before we see the actual way it unfolded, but does the Torah have something to say about which political system is correct? You know, was the Torah, you know, suggesting capitalism, socialism, anarchy, tyranny, monarchy? What was the Torah itself projecting? So before we even get to Shmuel Aleph, we need to think about that in a vacuum. And I remember for me, that was a bit of a moment where it caused me a little bit of thought, because if you think about it today, a lot of people in Western society will say the most advanced system of politics that we have is democracy. You may have said some people in the East to disagree, but nonetheless, they were outvoted. Essentially the question is the most sophisticated form of human government what the Torah is wanting? You know, so in that respect, the best place to look would be
the Torah.
The Torah, naturally. Where in the Torah would we talk about systems of government? Okay, so it happens to be, it's interesting, interestingly enough, there is an entire parasha in the Torah which is dedicated essentially to judgment and the role of judgment, and its name is Parshas Shoftim. Interestingly enough, sometimes you look at a parasha and you see incoherent sections. So you'll have, it'll look like, you know, an idea here, an idea there. Shoftim is a parasha which it's very easy to see how they all string together as one story. It talks about judges and what they preside over, and it talks about kings and what kings preside over. And if you want to take it as a whole, it's very fascinating. In fact, there was an individual who lived 600 years ago, whose name was Rabbeinu Nissim of Girona, and he wrote an essay, he wrote a number of drashas, and his book is called Drashas Haran, Rabbeinu Nissim, and his 11th drasha is dedicated to Parshas Shoftim, and he unpacks it in this manner with the bigger picture in mind. So there's lots to talk about over there. So when we return to the Torah itself, the Torah seems to talk about a specific political system. So here we have it. This is in Parashas Shoftim, in Devarim Perek Yud Zayin. Let's read it with we'll call it a non-judgmental eye, a mindful eye, and just try to absorb the facts, and then consider the questions afterwards. Okay, because let's try to reverse, you know, 2,500 years of history, 3,000 years of history, to try to read this with open eyes. So the Torah says the following: Kisavala aretz, when you come to the land, Asher Hashem Elokecha nosein lach, that Hashem is going to give to you, is giving to you, v'rishta, and you will inherit it, v'yoshavta bo, you will settle in it. V'amarta osimo alai melech kechol agoyim asher asivu asai. I want to place upon myself a king, like the rest of the nations that are around me. Somto osimo melech. In response to that, you shall surely place a king over yourselves. That God will choose for you ultimately. You have to establish the king from among your brethren. So he has to be some form of citizen. Who you cannot place somebody who is foreign. Right? Foreign nationals are not going to be eligible for the king, the highest office in the country. So now we have a few provisos. He should not have so many horses. because that's ultimately going to lead them to Egypt, because the finest steeds, even today, are Egyptian steeds. Right? So you don't want to send the people back to Egypt. That's not the way to go back. The king, even though in the practice, in those days, that polygamy was practiced, the king should not express himself in a way of many wives, because it's going to, it's in order that it should not distract him. The case of a zahav lo yarbe lo ma'od, and he should not invest in a lot of possessions. Now, those are three provisos, and then the Torah gives us a positive investment. It tells us, when he's sitting on his throne, he writes his own book of law in front of the priests. He should read it all the days of his life. The man yomad, in order that he should learn Yirayas Hashem Elokav, to fear his God, so that he should follow these laws, so he should not become arrogant above his brethren, that he should not waver to the right or the left. Fantastic. And in order that he should have longevity and his children should reign. So at this point in time, after reading what the Torah has told us about political systems, is it the Torah's vision to have a king?
Only if the people are asking for it. But
okay, so
the Torah is against.
Okay, so one noticeable fact is that the Torah does. Let's talk about the formulation of a mitzvah generally. A mitzvah is, if we translate that roughly into English, a mitzvah is like a positive commandment. A commandment, right? So therefore, I, as God, am telling you, human being, to do X, Y, and Z or Z. Okay? So it depends who's talking to, which continent. God is prescribing a particular action. Now, generally, an if-then is not a command, right? An if-then is more or less a formula, or maybe even a recommendation. So the way it's set up over here could be read as that if you ask for a king, then you should get a king. However, what's another way of reading that?
If you don't ask, you shouldn't get.
Okay, so meaning the natural logic would follow that it's only dependent on your actions, meaning on your request. That's one way of reading it.
No, it could mean that when you go to the land and you will say, I want a king.
Good, so therefore this is part of the narrative. Meaning, I'm telling you prophetically that this is kind of how it's going to end up happening. In such a situation, when the trigger is hit, then you will place a king upon yourself. So for instance, another example. If you're walking along the road and you happen to see a mother bird on the nest, you should chase away the mother bird in order to get to the eggs if you need them. So let's think about that for a moment. Does that mean to say that it's not a command? Well, it is a command. It's just the command is triggered under certain circumstances. So under the circumstances that you enter the land and you now realize that you're worthy of that state of policy, so then in that case, the command is to place a king. So it's not easy to know if the Torah is prescribing, describing, recommending. When at this point in time, just from the psukim themselves, I don't think there is a decisive way of saying that it is an absolute command or a description or recommendation at this point in time. Fair? Yeah.
Right. Is it there, for example, there's initially when they talk about Ben Sorer Marad that never happened.
Mm-hmm.
So you could probably apply that to this also. It's bringing it up in case in the event that it does happen.
Good.
But then in this case, meaning maybe it should have never happened.
That's a very good call. So meaning to say, there are mitzvahs, which are positive commandments, and they never occur. Meaning that they require certain circumstances, and those circumstances aren't met, then in fact you don't actually enter into the sphere of that mitzvah. Very positive, very possible, but we still haven't untangled one issue. And that is, the issue we haven't untangled is, was it a command or not? So meaning, does the Torah want this to happen? Because as opposed to Ben Sorer Moriah, I think we could go back into the divine psyche, so to speak, and that one, and know that God certainly does not want a Ben Sorer Moriah. But when it comes to a king, there's a little more, you understand, there's a little more gray area there. Does he really want it? Does he not really want it? It could end up not happening, right? But what is the divine will here?
But the Pasuk says specifically, that you're going to want to be like the Goyim. God isn't telling us to be like the Goyim.
Okay,
you're not suggesting we have a king so we could be like everybody
else. Very good point. So a fair point over here is maybe there's a negative narrative over here because the way you want it is for it to be like the nations of the earth. And that doesn't sound like generally a positive thing. Meaning, when do we learn from cultural norms? So maybe that's a we'll call it a meta-narrative of negativity. We'll have to see. Because there might be positivity that we can learn from the nations of the world to be continued on that. I want to hold on to your point. Is there political systems we can learn and import? That's going to be one of our questions as we go along. So anyway, so I just want to sequentially. So the next place we move on to, of course, is once we've considered the psukim have a great degree of ambiguity in this regard. So the next thing we do is... Wait, what's the next stop on the word?
Can I say something?
Sure.
We didn't look at the word v'amarta. You said it, not I said it, not God said it. So in other words, if you say you want a king, then you can have it.
You're right, but...
So it's you.
Correct, but in the next pasuk it says, Som tosim alecha melech, meaning I, Hashem, command you to place the king. So it's right that you started off by saying, but I'm telling you that you should place the king. Som tosim is me, God, telling you. So you're right, there is a trigger which is human. But ultimately, God is either agreeing with that human voice or actually directly commanding, right? So yes, one more comment, then we're gonna run because a lot of exciting stuff ahead.
This may be really off base, but do you think it's almost like setting them up to fail? Like, I'm giving you all these parameters. He can't have a lot of horses, and he can't have a lot of money, and he can't do this, and he can't do that. But what king really doesn't have a lot of money and have all those things?
Okay, so meaning to say, look around and, you know, folks, you know, you don't have to look too far to see that it's a difficult system. I think the way I would interpret the parameters is this is a very big minefield. Meaning, like, you know, if you have to put so many checks and balances on this fellow, then you realize that it comes with great challenge. And that the Torah seems to be setting it up in that way is, I know you want this king business, or I'm telling you to get this king, whichever way you want to read it, but this king comes with a lot of baggage. You know, and that's clear. You know, like, there's no other individual who has to have all these things. You know, there's no other individual who has to walk around with the Torah wherever they go. You know, if you think about it. So it's almost like he has to have that lesson of what the way he's going is held on to himself. So point well taken as well as to the, if we're going to infer what the Torah is saying. But again, that doesn't detract from the fact that it could be a command, but a command that has high stakes. So, our next stop is going to be actually the Gemara, the Mishnah itself. So the place that we arrive at is this actually appears in a Tosefta, and it appears in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin quotes the Tosefta on Daf Chaf from Abayez and says the following. Listen to this description, very fascinating. We're going to do two lines in it. V'chein hoya Rabbi Yehuda Omer. Rabbi Yehuda, who was one of the mid-range Tanaim, Tanatic teachers. So we're talking about about around just the first century Common Era, okay? Or just, I apologize, this is a little later, second century Common Era. He says, Shalosh mitzvos nistavu Yisrael b'chinisasam la'aretz. There were three mitzvos which Israel were commanded upon entering the land. La'amid lohem melech, to establish a king. La'achris zara shalamalek, to eradicate the seed of Amalek. V'livnois lohem beis ha'bechira, and to build a house of Hashem's Beis HaBechira, which is the chosen house, which means the Beis HaMikdash. Stop at this point in time. Rabbi Yehuda, you are now being interviewed. What do you think? Do you think the Torah, is this an imperative? Is this neutral? How do you understand the section of the Torah? Rabbi Yehuda would say, it is a mitzvah, meaning he is enumerating it as a command. So the way he read it is that perhaps that was the narrative or the necessary trigger to get into that situation, but once you're there, yes, when you enter the land, Som tosim alecha melech, you need the system. On the other hand, Rabbi Nuhurai Omer, Rabbi Nuhurai is a seems to be a colleague. He was also in the times of some people say he may have been Rabbi Meir. Lo nemra parshazu ela keneged tarum osam. This is only to actually relate to their complaints. Shenemar va'omarta osimo alei melech. You say, right, that is, you want a king, so therefore, relating to your request, I'm going to concede, says Hashem. So Rabbi Nuhurai is essentially taking the other side. Generally speaking, if we've done a fair and good analysis, we would hope to have found that the different sides of our analysis would appear in the analysis of Chazal, right? Meaning, if we did, and that's exactly what happens, right? Meaning, if we looked at the pasuk in a non-judgmental eye and try to leverage both sides, they do appear over here as these two these two giants of our early leadership. So it does split into these two ways. And the question is, so what became the predominant view? What was the predominant view? Because, interestingly enough, they're from the times of the Gemara and the Mishnah, actually. So that's skipping all the times that they were kings. What just happens to be fascinating is that as we read the Torah itself, the Torah sort of gives way to a little bit of ambiguity, which takes the form of different tracks already at the times of Chazal analyzing it retrospectively. What fascinates me is what was the actual halacha? I mean, what do they do? You know, so we're going to do it sort of round the back. The Rambam, Rav Moshe ben Maimon. So he's living now 800 years ago. The Rambam lives from 1135 to 1204. Okay, so he some people say 1138 to 1204. The Rambam is now codifying halacha. So what does he view as the, we'll call it, predominant tradition? Meaning he's looking at the greats of the previous 1,000 years before him, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nahurai. So what did he feel was the validated tradition? He says in source 5, so shalosh mitzvos nitzavu Yisrael b'shas knisas on aretz, lemanos lahem melech, shenemar som tosim olecho melech, ulahachriz zaru shalom olek, shenemar timcho yasech ramolek, velivno es besa v'chiro, shenemar l'shichno esidru shuvu v'asa shama. He quotes almost verbatim, word for word, which opinion is the Rambam actually codifying? Rabbi Yehuda, which means to say that he views this as an imperative. He views this as a command. So if you were to ask the Rambam how he viewed history, he viewed history that this was Hashem's immediate command, maybe with a few provisos, maybe with a few situational requirements to get there, but nonetheless, it wasn't an optional business. This was one of the three national mitzvahs. And the mitzvahs of national security are referred to King, Amalek's riddance, and Beis HaBechira. That sort of lines up the three main national mitzvahs of Israel as they enter the land. This is the way the Rambam views it. And by the way, this is what we get taught in general, okay? Which is why we never sort of thought about other systems in the Torah system, because generally speaking, I'm sure that many of us who went to day school or our kids or grandkids who come back from day school are busy when they say there are three mitzvahs and that's why we're supposed to go into the land and get rid of Amalek, and that's what Shaul HaMelech did, and he was supposed to be the king, and that's why he started getting rid of Amalek, and he wanted to build the Beis HaMikdash, but David then had, right? So this all feeds into the Rambam's way of looking at it, which is one side of the Machlokes of how to read those psukim. And this has sort of been the stamp throughout the history that Rambam is not generally contended with. However, what people do is actually, interestingly enough, when it comes to the Mefarshim, those who are trying to understand Tanakh on its own grounds, there's a lot more debate than the Rambam. So, I mean, the Rambam is pasking what he believes is halacha, but what really actually happens, the Mefarshim now debate, is that really the case or not, what actually occurred. So here's an example. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh, so Rav Chaim Ben Attar, who was born in Morocco and died in Yerushalayim, 16 to 1700s. His kever is on Har HaZeisim. You're able to visit it. It's towards the left from the when you were looking from the Shar HaAshbot. It's very worthwhile to have the opportunity to visit. So he says a very interesting thing. He says that, you know, if you were to ask me and say to me, look, what do you think the Torah really means? Which one is the safer way of reading it? He says the following. So let's take a look at the end of source 6, and this is the end of the first paragraph, about the second last line, towards the end of the line. He says, "Af al pi chein," he says, "nevertheless, tzarich liyashev akosov lisforas Rebbe Nuhurai, shepshat omro somtosim yagid shemitzas Hashem lo sumelech." He says, I believe that when reading these psukim, that when the Torah says "som tasim alecha melech," when you have a repetition of a word, "you shall put," "som tasim," "you shall surely put," it sounds like the Torah is trying to be very clear about the fact that you shall do this. You know, whenever you have a double word, it means the Torah is emphatically saying you shall do this at all costs. Usually, that's what the Torah means. So he says, how do you read Rabbi Nuhurai that this is optional? It was how do you read it into the psukim? Now the Gemara actually addressed that. The Gemara says it's about amarta. But he feels that the language of Som Tasim is too strong to make it simply an optional option. So take a look what he says. He says an interesting thing which gives us a little space of thought. Top of page 7. He says, "Ve'ev shalomar, it is possible to say, ki im Yisrael yiyu kasherim, ve'lo yishalu lamelech, ve'ya Hashem lamelech aleihem kederech amroi, ve'Hashem alokeichem malkechem. Were Israel not to ask for a king, then I could live somehow in a system in which Hashem was the ultimate governing body. Hashem was their king. As is described in Sefer Shmuel Aleph, that Shmuel says to the people, God is your king, why are you asking for a king? So meaning scenario one, option one in the fork in the road would be, is don't ask and then don't need. Option number two, Hashem really wants to be the only king of Israel. If they're asking a question, that they really want a king, then Hashem says, you know what? Okay, I will concede with you. Which means that the other way of reading this, as Rabbi Nohu Rai reads it, is that, look, there's actually a two-tiered system over here. The ultimate system, the way it should really work, the ultimate way it should be is, you don't need a king, God is your king, like Shmuel Navi says to the people. However, should you feel that you need a king for whatever reason, the Torah accommodates humanity, we're all frail and we all have our foibles. So the Torah says, you know what, in a society where you feel you really need a king, I'll make a mitzvah for that as well. So it's catering rather to human frailty, which means to say that asking for a king is not bad, but it's not the best. It's a weakness, right? It's not the ultimate system. Interestingly enough, by the way, in this way of looking at things, if Israel were to say, okay, look, we don't need a king, and they don't want to ask about it, so then what would the governing force in society be? Not clear, right? Not clear. Meaning, Hashem is the king, but, you know, Tachlis, I mean, steal something, right? So what happens, right? Tachlis is a murder, right? So what do you do, right? So there has to be courts and law of law. But where's the top of that pinnacle? Meaning, who's ultimately the CEO of that system, right? So meaning, right now there is a little bit of a vacuum in terms of what system could be there to adjudicate law, as Hashem is, you know, the ultimate power over that. But like on the human level, you know, so what system is in that place? It could be Shoftim, but then, you know, maybe the Sanhedrin HaGadol is at the top of that. But the point is that in tier one, there's a little bit of vagueness as to what the system would be. Maybe it's Shoftim, maybe because that's what preceded the Melachim. There was one person who assumed rulership, but there was no dynasticity. There was no continuum. Possibly. But what the Or HaChaim is suggesting is maybe there was a two-tiered system, which is very fascinating, because what he's introduced to us, it isn't an either-or, really, but it isn't a mitzvah or isn't a mitzvah. Maybe it's a conditional mitzvah, a mitzvah which sort of speaks to us as humans. It's interesting, you know, like, it's sometimes when you speak to, like, students and you offer somebody something, you say, you know, would you like the opportunity to go on this trip? And the person says, do I have to? You know, so the question itself has already answered what their attitude is. So, you know, like when the question has been asked, you know, can we have a king? Hashem already understands the attitude behind what's happening over there. And Hashem says, look, you know, if you're there already, then okay. You know, so that's kind of what's the psychology of it. Now, let's take a step backwards. There happens to be two people in history who sort of relate this to the times themselves. This comes back to Kochol HaGoyim for a moment. And they actually relate to what actually occurred in their society. So example number one, actually didn't manage to include it in the packet, was a person by the name of the Klei Yakar. Okay, the Klei Yakar is one of the Mefarshim on any page of Mikros Gedolos, the regular Mikros Gedolos. And he said something very interesting. He said that, look, the reason why kings are important, he said, is he's sort of analyzing this in a vacuum, and he says the reason why kings are important is very simple, and that is that you need to have in society law and order. You need to have the fact that there's accountability, that people can't go around and riot and anarchy and breaking store windows whenever you want. There needs to be one individual who's going to exact justice and will punish people by default. And be a presence in society. Because you know what happens is that if you don't have a king, if you have, let's say, you know, like we see in some of the countries around us, he says, let's say elected officials or people who don't have absolute power, what ends up happening? Then there's not really that same sense of awe, that same sense of law and order, which is accomplished when you have a king themselves. And he, in fact, goes so far as to say that in Sefer Shmuel, which we're going to deal with next week, as you pointed out, Dina, one of the failings of Israel was, is they said, we want to have a king like all the nations around us, meaning to say, we want to have somebody who's going to be a yes man. We're going to want to have somebody who's going to say, we're going to come to him on Tuesday and say, you know, the babysitter lets us stay up past 11 o'clock. And he says, really? And he says, yeah, absolutely. This is what my parents wrote a note and got lost. And the king will give the rubber stamp and do whatever they want. They wanted to have a yes man. And says the Kleyakor, the point of a king is a person who's not going to be a yes man. A person who's not going to be swayed by the wills and the whims of society. A person who doesn't have to worry about elections. A person who is able to affect judgment and affect fear in society in order to establish law and order. So what he says is, interesting enough, is the Kleyakor is saying, look at society around us. Look at all the failings of leadership which is not strong, which is not firm. That's what the Torah is saying is you need to have it. Now, coming back to the points that were raised, that's why if you give such a person so much power, you have to put so many checks and balances on that power. I mean, that's why he has to carry the Torah around. That's why he has to have fettered lifestyle in terms of his lust, in terms of all his earthly living. Why? Because when you vest so much power in an individual, it's dangerous. There are failings, and go look at, you know, do a case study on kings. It doesn't work out many times. That's one side, which is interestingly found in the Mepharshim. Here's the other side. This side I think we can perhaps resonate more with. The person who speaks about this is Rav Don Yitzchak Abarbanel. Don was not his name. Don was actually his political title. He was perhaps, I would say, arguably, the most powerful Jew who lived in the diaspora. You could argue this. There are a number of individuals who really were up there, but Abarbanel was perhaps one of the most powerful and influential Jews who ever lived in diaspora communities. He was a minister in the Portuguese government in the late 1400s, and he was upon the expulsion of Portuguese Jewry. He was actually offered safety. And he refused it. When he was in Spain, he was the minister of the treasury, if I'm not mistaken. He was a very, very powerful person. In fact, he himself would negotiate with Ferdinand and Isabella to try to obviate or to remove the need for the expulsion of the Jews unsuccessfully. And even though he himself was offered against a safe haven, he left and he went to Europe. He went to Venice. And to Vienna, I apologize. And it was during that time that he wrote his Pirush on the Neviim Rishonim. You know, like he says in his introduction, those 2 weeks that I had in this one place, I was in peace and quiet. I wrote this Pirush. You know, so it's quite remarkable. That's what we're learning now. He was a very, very powerful individual, respected for his diplomacy, respected for his skills across the known world. And so he has a lot to say about kings, because he dealt with kings. So listen to what he has to say. It's interesting. He has a long diatribe here in Sefer Shmuel and in the Torah, where he goes to great lengths. We're not going to go to great lengths, but let's take a look at the first paragraph of what he says in Source 7, page 7. He says the following. Hibitu ru'u haratzos shetiyeh hanogosom al yedei melochim. Folks, let's take a look at all the countries that are governed by kings. The tiru is shikutzehem v'skilu lehem. See the atrocities which have been committed in such countries. They decide they want to do something. They decide they want to expel Jews one day. There is no force which can check that balance. Check that. There's no. They can do whatever they decide they want. I'm reading a book now, which is called Anglica Judaica, about the history of the Jews in England. And it was, you know, of course, before Magna Carta, before the barons sort of checked the power of the king. But the king really, you know, could do pretty much whatever they wanted. You know, you have to read what they did to Jews. You know, like he suddenly wanted money, he just levied a tax, where the Jews in the next month had to pay up, you know, however many thousand or whatever it was to pay him, just at a whim. There was no check of power. We don't even know what that means in Western society. You know, we complain about minister appointments today. You know, but secretary appointments. But like there were much more terrifying things going on in those days when it came to totalitarian. So he says, look at that. Umi yomar lo ma'ata aseh. Who can tell him what to do? He says, today, in modern society, right? Late 1400s, for early 1500s, ra'inu artzos rabos tianago samayadeh shoftim moshlim zmaniyim. He says, we see that there's countries and cities which are governed by elected officials. So he says, there are people who have even short terms, like 3 months, he says, but there are people who have governance just for very short terms. And they are the ones to arrange the wars and the country policies. Lo yamod ish mipneihem ki im leshevet im laartzam lo lechesed v'im ish yachtameihem bidvarma od ma'at yavo acherim tachteihem. So if a person therefore is found cheating on, you know, taking from the public coffers, if a person is found exacting judgment illegally, what's going to happen? The next election's coming, so they're now going to be deposed off from office, and therefore there's an accountability. And therefore they are also under the umbrella of the legal system. They themselves are in the system. But they shouldn't carry on doing this. There's accountability. He says, look at the Roman Empire. You know, there was, you know, at the beginning there was one emperor who was, did whatever they wanted. When there was the Senate, there was at least some form of balance. But when you had one emperor, then it all just fell apart, right? So he says that when you have absolute power, it corrupts. So he says, look at. I think that's Vienna. Hagoveres, hagiveres, rabosi bagoyim sarasa bamidinos. Look at this fine city, Vienna. Look how famed it is among all surrounding countries. Umalchus Florencia, Sevihu lecholarazos. It's a beautiful city. Obviously, they had their own governance in those days. So he's not talking about Italy as a whole, but he's saying, you know, that, or Austria, but he's saying that these specific cities, look at the way they work. They operate beautifully. Umalchus Geneva, Dechel v'takifo, the strong city of Geneva. They have staged and termed offices, and they work fantastically. They don't have any problems or crookedness. Now, he's always talking in the early days of democracy. Lo yarim ishes yadoi ves ragloi. Nobody's going to raise their hand or foot. I'll call the var pesha in crime. The hema koiv shois artzois lo lohem b'chokhma ketvuna v'das. And they're able to, in fact, not only just remain, they're actually successful in expanding their borders. So Abba Nel says in no uncertain terms, and he goes on to describe this, that he believes that when the Torah says som tisim alecha melech, it is very much of a di'evet. He feels that the Torah, it's at best a rishus, a neutral, and the Torah is really catering towards, or perhaps prophesizing, what may come to be. But the Torah is not telling us to establish a system of government. The Torah is not prescribing at all. And it's just interesting to see how stark the differences are when you read, let's say the Klei Yakor, and he's worried about our yes people, right, as being our leaders. And you read the Abba Nel, who says, you need to have people who are accountable, ultimately, in order to be able to do this, to be able to survive. It's interesting, like, you know, when you go back to the founding fathers, the framers of the American Constitution, this was obviously in the forefront of their minds. You know, when you're like, you know, Abraham Lincoln was not a framer many years later, but the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. He felt that the ultimate system of government would be somebody where every single person is under the law. In fact, in the Constitution itself, that we in Article 2, Section 4, with our in Source 9, the President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for the conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes or misdemeanors. Which means to say that the system of democracy which America has professed is a democracy where even the greatest and most powerful come under the system of law, which was a chiddush in terms of systems of judgment. So it's interesting to see that reflecting on history, there's also a lot of, you know, the Mefarshim have a lot more to say when it comes to what should be the recommended system, what the Torah really was saying. Was the Torah actually saying it or not? Now, as a interesting closing thought, just this to me is very fascinating, is that it depends where you go. You know, it really depends where you go. So, you know, they say the joke, which is, I'm trying to remember the exact details, but I think that there was a journalist going doing a questionnaire around the world and trying to get as many questions from different countries. And the question was, you know, like, what is this, you know, they go around and says, one of the questions was, sir or madam, what is, do you mind if I ask your opinion? What is your opinion of caviar? Okay, so he, you know, he goes around to the numerous countries. He goes to Israel. He says, excuse me, sir, what is your opinion of caviar? And the Israeli says, what do you mean by excuse me? And then he goes to the, you know, he goes to sub-Saharan Africa and says, excuse me, what's your opinion about caviar? And they said, what's caviar? And then he goes to, you know, up east in Siberia, and he says, excuse me, sir, I'd like to ask your opinion. What do you think about caviar? So he says, what's an opinion? Right? So in certain places, everything, it's relative as to how much are the rights of the individual and how much are the rights of government, depending on where you are. Speaking to this is the words of Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Netziv. And I think this is so true, and this gives such good analysis of this whole thing retrospectively. Listen to what he says. It is such a profound statement, he says. He's talking exactly in Devarim, Perek Yud Zayin, and he says the following. He says, let's start at the very top in source 10. He says, Avamarta Vogaymer, he says, Eina Pirush Amira Kamashmo Oi, Befer, Ela Kaloshin Vamarta Ochla Basar Vakadome. Okay. 1 second. He says, Achein, Lefi Loshon Ze, Hoya Bamashmo Shein Ze Mitzvah, Bamuchlat Lemanos Melech, Ela Rushus, Kamoi Vamarta Ochla Basar. The way it's formulated in the Torah, he says, seems to indicate that it's only if you want it, then you get it. Like, the example he's comparing it to is, is there a mitzvah to shecht animals?
Yes. If you want to eat them.
If you want to eat them. There is a mitzvah. Well, it's called a mitzvah kiyumis. A mitzvah kiyumis means to say that there is a kiyuma mitzvah, but it's not a chiyuvis. It's not an obligatory mitzvah. So should you decide you want to eat meat, then there's a kiyum mitzvah by shechting. But if you don't want to eat, then you haven't entered the circumstances of the mitzvah, so therefore it's not a mitzvah chiyuvis. That's the way that. So what he's saying is, it sounds like that type of mitzvah. Okay, that's the halachic framework that he's putting it in, which sounds very similar to Or HaChaim. But now listen to what he says. V'harei yodu b'divrei Chazal to mitzvah l'manos melech. He says, but Chazal tell us, as we saw, Rabbi Yehuda seems very unequivocal that it is a mitzvah. V'imkein l'maiksiv v'amarta. Why then, if it is obligatory, does it say v'amarta? You will say, meaning what's your opinion worth in whether it's a mitzvah or not? He says, Venire, he has his suggestion. Demishum dahanhaga samadina mishtane im misnaig alpidas melucha or alpidas ha'am v'nivcharehem. There's different systems of government. There's certain governments which work better with kings. There's certain systems of government which work through elected officials. V'yesh medina she'eino yecholo lispol das melucha. There are certain countries that simply can't have one person who's deciding everything, and there's a totalitarian type of regime. V'yesh medina shebeloy melech hareyu kesvina beloy karbanit, and they're bli karbanit. So it is like a country which it is like a ship. If it were not to have a king, it would not work. It would be like a ship without a captain. He says, "Davar ze yevshar la'asos al pi ha'hechrech mitzvah sasei." The Torah therefore can't prescribe one definite system of government. The Torah can't say, folks, there's one way or the highway. This is going to be it. You're going to have a king. Because some countries can only operate with a king. Some countries can only operate without a king, and then you have elected officials. So what does the Torah do? The Torah frames it in a way that only when you feel like you need that, do you enter into the mitzvah kiyumis of having a king, which is such a profound point. What the Netziv is ultimately saying is that it doesn't work for everybody. You know, if you're to look in the Middle East right now, you know, without making political comments, but, you know, some countries need dictators. You know what I'm saying? Meaning, ultimately speaking, you know, they're pretty bad dictators and they do terrible things. But there are certain people who need to be governed by dictators, and when you take them away, the vacuum which ensues leads to the chaos we're watching. Now, the dictators are not wonderful people, and certainly in the case of Syria, he is a terrible human-killing person. But let's say when you remove a Saddam Hussein and leave in the vacuum nothing, what happens? ISIS arises. And the anarchy in the absence of a strong king-like leader is bad in certain areas in the world. Whereas if you're to say over here, well, let's put a dictator into America, the country would fall apart. Right? It wouldn't work. I'm not making any implications. So what the Netziv is saying is a very interesting point. The Netziv is saying is that the Torah was aware and sensitive to the fact that not every glove fits every hand. And therefore, the Torah says to Israel, folks, it's up to you. When you feel that you need it, if you should so feel, if you feel like eating meat, if you feel like you need a king, I'm creating a framework for kingship. And I'm going to do it, of course, with my parameters and my provisos and so on. But that doesn't mean to say that you need to do it. In fact, you could possibly have another political system which would work all the way through the rest of society and time, and you wouldn't need to have a king. And that's the framework over here. So now, if that's the case, I think that's a very fair reading of this, because as we know today, there are kings and there are dictatorships and there are democracies in the world. Some work, some don't, but on both sides there are some not working. What ends up happening is now into that, now we have to say, okay, so now let's ask Shmuel. So Shmuel, what was so bad here? Okay, if we have the options and they're opting in to option B, so what's so bad that it made Shmuel so upset that he was that they were asking? And that's our work next week, is to look at Shmuel. What's going to complicate our mission is that Shmuel doesn't seem to have one single narrative. Okay, we're going to see that Shmuel seems to think different things at different times, and we're going to try to put together his words to see what he really means. So looking forward to continuing.